Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it.
So this one is really interesting, Joanne, because you probably don't know this. I actually began my dissertation on Henry Clay. I started to write a book about Henry Clay and got several months into it, and discovered that quite a prominent historian was already writing a biography of Henry Clay. Oh. And I felt that I did not want to be in that same space as that prominent historian. So after much rending of clothes and tears, I dropped that topic and started the research for a new dissertation. So Clay and I go way back.
But that's thus my question. What brought you to him in the first place?
I was interested in the way he thought about ideology, about what the way he thought the government should act, because he is such a changing moment in the way people think about the government that he wants to use it quite actively for his American system and to go ahead and develop the country. And it just was such a change. And I had been really profoundly influenced by Daniel Walker Howe's The Political Culture of the American Whigs. And I've always been fascinated by the way people think about things. Versus the way things really are. And Clay was a central figure in, I'm going to think about something in a different way. And so I've always kind of had a soft spot for him. And of course, you've covered him, but in a really different way than a thinker.
What just grabbed me was you said you're interested in what people think about things as opposed to the way things really are. And in a way, in my writing about Congress, I was interested in how things really were. Also, the assumptions that made them act that way, but it was the ground level how things really were. And Clay, I mean, certainly if you're writing a book about Congress, Clay's going to be in it for all of the reasons we talked about during the episode and more. But if you're writing about how people behave in Congress to each other, he was kind of a big figure because he was the great compromiser. And, you know, I found out, among other things, he tried to compromise a duel from happening. It didn't work, but he tried. And when Southerners didn't understand what Northerners meant, he sometimes translated Northern into Southern, you know, so that Southerners understood what the Northerners were actually trying to say. He's an interesting character. But what made me realize that he had to really be in my book is he could be a real fighter, not necessarily with guns and knives like some of my congressmen, but there was an incident that's in John Quincy Adams' diary. And he talks about someone coming to him who had been arguing something, debating about something on the floor, and Clay had turned on him and had just thrown a bunch of cruel remarks at him, just attacked him. And this man, I wish I could remember the details. I did not look it up before this conversation. This man came to Adams with tears in his eyes because he had not been treated like that before in Congress. And I thought that was fascinating because that's certainly not the Clay image that he gives or that we get in a lot of ways, but that was, you know, sort of ground level politics Clay. And the fact of the matter is he was the great compromiser because he was engaged in so many conflicts and fights. He was good at compromising, but, you know, part of what made you a great politician in that era was being able to either engage that way with others or know how to respond to it and take care of yourself. And he was right in that mix in that way as well. And I guess that kind of, it surprised me to see him in that light on such a ground level. And it also surprised me, whoever, you know, this congressman who was kind of teary at being attacked by him. It's just one of those moments where you get a flash of light on, in my case, you know, the institution of Congress, some moment in history. And there's this little glimmer of the humanity of that moment that kind of slaps you in the face, you know, with one diary entry. And for me, it had something to do with Clay.
Well, and so, but it's interesting you say that, because what I find fascinating about the speakership is the skills that you need to go ahead and nail together the coalitions that you're going to have to use to get your bill over the finish line. And it seems to me like when we think about speakers, we either think about the ones who stand out. I mean, there's a lot of speakers who really are not memorable in any fashion, but the ones that are memorable are either operating from a position of purely power, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to ram this down everybody's throats because I've got the votes to do it. And this is just what's going to happen. Or the ones who compromise and figure out how to bring coalitions together. And the power angle of it doesn't interest me all that much. I'm interested, I guess, in the mechanics of that. But I'm fascinated by these people like a Tip O'Neill, like Nancy Pelosi, who can put pressure way over there on that person. And it ripples through the caucus in such a way that, you know, weeks later, somewhere else, they've managed to put something together. And that, to me, it's like watching one of those machines that they have in the Logan Airport where they drop a ball and, you know, 45 minutes later, another ball comes out the other end because there have been bells and whistles and things moving. And because I can't see that. I can watch it happen, but I cannot take a look at 100 people and say, oh, wow, if I put pressure on this person, they're going to put pressure on this person to do that, and that's going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and, you know, and all the way down to this person's going to vote for my bill.
Okay, I find this actually really fascinating, linking up how you look at things and how I look at things, because I would be interested in my work precisely on how the push of that person ended up with something else happening on the bill. I would want to see, and I would uncover the weird personal conversations, the hatred of this guy for that guy, the longstanding relationship of this guy and this other guy having a real problem coming up in a race at home, so he's worried about his reputation, and the threat someone gave to someone the other day that meant this guy couldn't answer in that way. I would be interested in uncovering all of the personal decisions and moments that led people to make certain decisions that led to that outcome, and thus the way in which that speaker knew in some ways to play, to put that marble in a particular path. I'm always fascinated by the human connection of politics and what, you know, we tend to see politics and policy top down, but policy doesn't exist without the conflict and everything happening on a human level, the indecision and the bad choices and the hatred and the weird pettiness and everything else. Seems like it's just sort of, oh yeah, whatever, it's trivial, it's just emotion, but that's how politics does or doesn't get done.
Well, yes, I'm fascinated by it. I couldn't begin to do it. I mean, that's the thing that I find so fascinating. And you say that, and one of the things that absolutely springs to mind for me is when Congress is debating or going to pass the 13th Amendment, because they have to pass it through Congress before they send it off to the states for ratification. And of course, we all triumph of the passage of that. But one of the things that was key to getting that through is that morning, somebody put on all the congressmen's desks pictures of the Andersonville prison camp. And then, of course, even still, they didn't have all the votes they needed. So at least the rumor goes that Abraham Lincoln made an offer to some guy's brother for a position in the government if the guy who didn't show up to vote that day. And I believe he didn't. So there's like wheeling and dealing. Your brother needs a job. I can make that happen. But for me, the fact that somebody said, I know how we can get people to vote for this. We'll put photographs of Andersonville on the desk. Honest to God, that would never in a million years occur to me. I'd be like, oh, wow, Andersonville is so terrible. We need to talk about that. But first, let's vote. I would not think to put those two things together.
No, but and it's putting them together that fascinates me about politics. It's the fact that if you're a really skilled politician, you know those things and you can play those angles and you think that way. You know, you think like one congressman I wrote about who put pamphlets on everyone's desk showing something embarrassing about another congressman because he just wanted to slap at him a little before the guy stood up to give a speech or something. You know, these weird, seemingly petty things. But what that shows you is a lot about not just politics, but what people are assuming about the functioning of politics, the nature of politics, how does a democratic politics work or not work, and what are the assumptions in people's heads about what is or isn't proper to do as a politician. Those are personal and small questions that end up having really, really big implications and repercussions. And it's that kind of uncovering, you know, reading diaries and private letters to come up with, you know, the diary says, for example, that Henry Clay yelled at someone, and then I'll find a private letter and the person will say something like, you know, I saw Clay's face when he did this nasty thing the other day, and I think, and you put those things together and suddenly you're creating a moment of political action and choice.
How often do you see that, though?
I see it, I don't want to say with regularity, it happens, but it happens, sometimes it'll be years apart. So for example, at one point I remember I found a letter at the Library of Congress. It said, P.S., what do you think about that thing with Toombs and Fremont? And that's all it said. And I was like, what do you think of that thing with Toombs and Fremont? And I thought, that sounds to me like there's trouble. Like in my world of violence and politics in Congress, that sounds like it's up my alley. It was probably 5 years later, and I was at the New York Public Library, and I was looking at some Thomas Hart Benton files, and lo and behold, and he's Fremont's father-in-law, and lo and behold, there is an explanation of exactly what happened, which was indeed that the two of them were sort of edging around fighting a duel, and I think Benton spoke with Fremont about whether it was wise or unwise to fight a duel and what it would do for his reputation, and particularly if he wanted to be president. So, you know, it took 5 years, but suddenly I was like, I knew it. Like, I knew. And then it had so much to say about running for president and what people were and weren't considering and trying to promote themselves for that office.
So this is the heartbreak of this present moment with text messaging and all the different things, is that you know those records are there. You know they're there. But the question is, how many of them are going to be preserved? Because, like, for me, I can't tell you how much I would love to be on the select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Could they have put more words in the title of that committee? Because they're, with luck, going to get a chance to look at it. But can you imagine if we could really look at people's text messages, politicians' text messages and all that? Not for blackmail or exposure or anything like that.
No, just to get at it.
To
see it.
Yeah. And to see what is changing a vote. And so a lot of what I do when I look at the modern world is to watch what's happening in public and say, oh, wait, there was just pressure here and there was pressure here. And I sort of feel like I'm following along, breadcrumbs behind somebody eating a sandwich, trying to figure out what's in the sandwich. Whereas
I'm just digging up stale breadcrumbs.
Well, like you say, it's incredibly important, but somebody like a Clay or an O'Neill and probably a Pelosi knows how to do it. I actually have a colleague who's very good at that. I had a colleague before who was very good at that. And I used to just watch him in awe because he'd put a little bit of pressure over here. And 6 months later, all of a sudden you'd go, I get it. I see. And I just could never think that way.
But here's the thing that comes to mind when you talk about, you know, text messages and what's going to survive. I was employed by the Library of Congress for a number of years. And I remember sitting in a meeting in the manuscript division. And the meeting was, and just the division, it's the manuscript division. So it's got, you know, papers of congressmen and other such related political figures. The meeting was essentially, what are we collecting? Because we're sure not collecting manuscripts and papers so much anymore. I mean, we are, but they're probably public documents. And this is before social media. This is a while back. You know, are we collecting, like, you know, while you were out, notes from phone calls? I mean, what are we collecting? So that many years ago, that was probably in the 90s, the late 90s, maybe? Oh, no, it was earlier than that. It was in the 90s at any point. It was before social media was as big as it is now, obviously. They were already thinking about, what are we going to collect? What are we going to have here to enable people in the future to recreate this history? And the irony of that is, as an early American historian, I'm always digging for the stale breadcrumbs, right? I'm always like trying desperately to find evidence. And sometimes you just know there's no evidence. And I look at people who work on the 20th century or the 21st century, and I think, holy smoke, the amount of evidence, right? There's like radio, TV, social media. There's like, it's everywhere. I wouldn't know how to start. I like my world where there's a limited number of places you can go. And if you get really creative, you could find great stuff. That said, we're looking at all of the ways in which there might be a lot of stuff, but it's not all going to be valuable stuff. And it's often going to contradict. And it will be difficult to find ways to undo those kinds of wrangles, because that kind of evidence will no longer exist.
needle in haystack in the 21st century for finding stuff. And I have to say, I'm with you on people who do the 20th century. There's just way too much stuff, really, after the Hoover administration. But I look at your era and I think, there's no evidence. How do you do anything? There's this wonderful sweet spot in between those two things, and it's called the 19th century, where we have voluminous conversations, lots of paper, but not so much you can't begin to do it. So
I say the same thing about historians of ancient Greece and Rome. I'm like, oh, they have so little evidence, whereas in my era, we have so much more.
But I'm just trying to bring you over here to the dark side, because you too could read the papers of Thomas Reed.
Well, I read a lot of 19th century papers for this last book. I did. And it's a different kind of research. Totally true.
It really is different when you do politics of the 19th century.
One way or another, I just like the hunt.
Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com. See you next time.